this is not just a genetic disease, because for years we've been sort of thinking about it as a genetic disease. So we think, well, it's just sort of pre-programmed into us. But it's not, because the rates of cancer depend on your environment more than it does on your genes.
Hi everyone, Drew Pro here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today we are asking ourselves the most fundamental of questions, which is, what exactly is cancer? You may think you know, but my guest today, Dr. Jason Fung, is going to help you completely reimagine it and understand it, because he's going to summarize the history of cancer, most importantly, focusing on the last 15 to 20 years, which have completely changed the way that we think of cancer. Is cancer this random disease that randomly attacks the human body, or is it part of our evolutionary response? Is it a survival mechanism baked deep into our human genome? And is it something that helps us survive toxic environments? Well, we're going to go into all that and more in today's episode. If you care about cancer, if your family has been touched by this horrific disease, you won't want to miss this episode. Stay tuned. Quick shout out to today's sponsor, Magnesium Breakthrough by Bio Optimizers. I first heard of this incredible supplement that has over 7 different forms of magnesium in it from my brother-in-law, who's a cardiologist who had been taking it to support his sleep. He called me up one day and said I'd been taking this thing called Magnesium Breakthrough, and it's incredible. It's helping me sleep better. So I got curious, and we reached out to the company and thought it'd be a fantastic fit for the podcast, because shortly after my brother-in-law, my fiance and I started taking it to support our sleep. Magnesium is so crucial. A little background on magnesium. So most of our soils have become depleted of magnesium. It's a tough mineral to get enough of through diet alone. 80% of Americans are actually deficient in it, and it's crucial for hundreds of reactions in the body. I actually found out from a past podcast guest that it's over 400 different functions inside of the body. It impacts everything from metabolism to sleep, neurological health, energy, pain, muscle function, stress response, and so many other aspects. As I mentioned, Magnesium Breakthrough, game-changing product. It has over 7 different forms of magnesium, which all have different functions in the body. There's seriously nothing like it on the market. I know, I looked, I haven't found anything like it. All their products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, and made with all natural ingredients. I love the fact that they give back to their community too. For every 10 bottles sold, they donate one to someone in need. Right now, for my audience, BioOptimizers is offering a Black Friday and Cyber Monday deal to my listeners for the entire month of November. That's the thing to do these days. They're offering free shipping up to 40% off on select products, and they're giving away free bottles of their amazing enzyme P30M, as well as their HCL breakthrough supplement. If you're interested and you need a magnesium in your life, just go to biooptimizers.com. That's BioOptimizers.com, biooptimizers.com/brain. You can find it in the show notes and use the code BRAIN10 to receive this amazing offer. I think you'll love BioOptimizers Magnesium Breakthrough as much as my fiance and my brother-in-law and I do. Now back to this week's episode. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, mindset, and more. I'm your host, Drew Pruitt, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Dr. Jason Fung. Dr. Fung is a physician, author, and researcher. His groundbreaking science-based books about diabetes and obesity, The Diabetes Code, The Obesity Code, and The Complete Guide to Fasting have sold over, get this, 1 million copies, and they've changed significantly the conventional wisdom that diabetics should be treated with insulin as a primary method of intervening in improving their health. Dr. Fung is the co-founder of the Fasting Method, a program to help people lose weight and reverse, you heard that right, reverse type 2 diabetes naturally with
fasting. His work on fasting has been cited in all the major media outlets, CNN, Time, The Atlantic, Forbes, Toronto Star, and many, many others. His upcoming book, which is what we're talking about today, The Cancer Code, A Revolutionary New Understanding of a Medical Mystery, will take you on an incredible journey on the history of cancer and the potential of where we're going so you can improve your health. It's out on November 10th. Dr. Fung, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I'm really excited. Many of our listeners know that my my family, like a lot of families out there, has been touched by cancer. My mom, a few years ago, about 10 years ago, was diagnosed with breast cancer. I've had aunts that have been also diagnosed with breast cancer, and my grandfather passed away of bone cancer that was there. So I think I'm representative of a lot of people who have been through this journey supporting family members and are just curious, not only for their own health and their family's health, but curious about what is this thing. And I want to first start off by saying, you know, your books and the way that you approach writing, I really appreciate, because you are taking a premise, an idea that people seem to hold as true, and you're bringing a new contrarian thinking. We used to think of fasting as being this restrictive thing, potentially dangerous, and you highlighted the research around that field that helped us understood that fasting is actually central to healing inside of our body with things like diabetes and other diseases. And you're doing it again with cancer by questioning the basic premise. And I want to pull a quote from your book to start off the conversation, which is, you say, and you start off in the book, you say, the most pressing question in cancer research is the most elusive question: what is cancer? So can we start off there? Because it's still a question that we're asking today, which is, what exactly is cancer?
Yeah, and that's sort of the most important thing is to understand a disease. You really have to understand what it is, like what causes it, what, you know, what the disease is. And really, for the of the common diseases, cancer stands virtually alone because we have no idea what this disease actually is. So you look at other diseases like COVID or, you know, infections. So we've identified viruses, we've identified bacteria, we've, you know, figured out fungi. And so these are external invaders for heart disease and stuff. These are, you know, blockages in our blood vessels, which starve the heart or the brain of blood. So you get heart attacks or strokes. So we sort of understand what the disease is, how it develops, and that kind of thing. But for cancer, this is sort of a very, very strange disease. So it's unlike any other disease we've ever faced. It's not a vascular disease like heart disease. It's not an external invasion like bacteria or viruses. You know, it's not a, you know, stones and stuff. There's all these other diseases, but what is this strange disease? And it's not that it's one of these sort of rare diseases. It's unfortunately extremely common. So the lifetime risk of cancer is somewhere around 1 in 10. And it's going to, you know, affect everybody's life in that if you don't get it, you will know people who will get it. Almost everybody does. But we don't know what this is. And this is the whole sort of discussion in the book, is what is this disease? Because it's a disease where you have a normal cell, which is part of your own body, because it's derived from your own body. And for some reason, this normal cell breaks off and becomes cancerous to the point where it can kill you. And it kills, of course, many, many people. It's the second biggest killer of people. So our concept of what this disease actually is has been changing. So, you know, it's changed throughout history, but really even in the last sort of 10 years, there's been this massive change in the way that we look at this disease. And this is what I call the paradigm of cancer. That is, you know, I'm not arguing about, oh, this, you know, this is how to treat cancer. Like, we've done lots of studies on, you know, use this drug and these drugs in combination with surgery and chemotherapy and radiation. You put them in this sort of regimen and you can treat cancer. And I'm not disputing any of that. But in the end, it doesn't help you answer the question of what is it. So if you want to understand what it is, then you have to start sort of from the beginning, go through it and say, what is this disease? And that's where we've really made a lot of progress within the last sort of 15, 20 years. And most people haven't even really appreciated that. And that's what I wanted to bring forward, is that sort of recent research, and bring it to the people so they at least understand what this disease is that is affecting so many people.
And you do that. We were chatting a little bit before the interview started. You do that so eloquently in there, and you've outlined basically the three major paradigm shifts that have been there in the world of cancer. And before we get into kind of like the central thesis of you highlighting the work that really has been understood in the more recent years, let's take the listeners of the podcast through this journey, right? Let's take them through the paradigm 1, 2, and then eventually number 3, so they can understand and really go back to that central question, which is, what is cancer?
Yeah, so this is such an interesting story, because this is sort of the whole crux of the mystery that is cancer. So where we started was, you know, the question is, say, what is cancer? Because cancer has been around a long time. You can go back, you know, to mummies and stuff, and you'll still be able to find archaeological evidence of cancer even back in antiquity. So it's a disease that's been there forever. And the first sort of modern paradigm, you can start actually even before that with the ancient Greeks, and the ancient Greeks thought it was this sort of excess of this humor. So they believed in the humoral theory, where all diseases were caused by an imbalance of the four humors, and too much black bile was caused by cancer. That turned out not to be true. But they did give us the name cancer, which is derived from the word carcinos, which means crab, which is very interesting because the cancer does sort of tend to scuttle around the body and metastasize. Then through the 18th century, 19th century, they developed the microscope. So they really focused on the cell, and they could see that this cancer cell is related to a normal cell, but bizarre and different in certain ways. And they're able to categorize the ways in which these cancer cells were different than normal cells. So for example, if you had a lung cell, normal lung cell, you could look at it under the microscope, and then you could look at a lung cancer cell, and you could identify the differences, even though there's a lot of similarities between the two, because the cancer cell is originally derived from the healthy cell. So that was the first big sort of paradigm of cancer, was, well, these are cells that really just grow too much. So normal cells don't grow. Like if you have a normal lung, your lung does not just keep going bigger and bigger until your head pops off your neck, right? It just sort of stays the same size, which means that the number of cells that are dying is equally matched by the number of cells that are being born every day. And there's a lot. I mean, the body has maybe 10 trillion cells that are being sort of born every day, and that many have to die every day in order for us to maintain a normal sort of lung, for example, so that it doesn't just keep getting bigger. A lung cancer, of course, is totally different. That is, it will just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it affects everything around it. So that's the big problem with cancer, is that it just grows. And then after it grows for a while, it actually spreads around the body. And then by spreading, it affects the normal function of those organs, or just by the sheer size, it's going to affect other things. So that was the first great paradigm, was this is a disease of cells that grow too much. And that, by taking that paradigm, you can say this is our understanding of what the disease is, and therefore you design treatments around that paradigm. So if this is a disease of too much growth, then this logical solution, kill cells, right? That's it. So the treatments that we derived were surgery, so basically cutting out the cancer. It had radiation, which is a more sophisticated way of burning the cancer, and that developed in the 1910s, 1920s, for example. And then in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, you started to see the beginning of chemotherapy, which are basically selective poisons. So they kill certain cells faster than they kill other cells. So the idea is to kill the cancer before you kill the patient. These are all poisons. Like, not to put too fine an edge on it. These are all indiscriminate ways of killing cells, burning and poisoning.
Okay. Almost a little bit like you sometimes give the analogy of like warfare, right? We talk about the war on cancer. Yeah. This is warfare on parts of our body that we've deemed to be out of control.
Exactly. So what we're doing is we're taking this sort of paradigm of excessive growth and applying logical solutions to excessive growth, which is ways of killing cells. So that makes a lot of sense. And it's not to take away from this paradigm. I mean, these are still the basics of treatment today. Like, even though this was from a while ago, we still use chemotherapy, we'll still use surgery, we still use radiation all the time these days. It's sort of the backbone of what we do. But it very soon came to the limits of where you could go. So 50s, 60s, 70s, there's a huge explosion in the number of chemotherapy agents, the way you combine them. So that was a huge advance, for example, when you're able to combine two or three different ones in specific ways. So you get this and this, and then 3 weeks later, you get this, this, and this. And then 3 weeks later, you get this and this. And you can combine it with chemo, you can combine it with surgery, you can combine it with radiation, and come up with this whole sort of cocktail and regimen that you go through. And survival of cancer, especially pediatric cancers, really improved dramatically through that period. But it reaches a limit.
And just to jump in, pediatric cancers, because again, kind of like in the book, you talk about there's always consequences with these items. So pediatric cancer, these young children who tend to have, in general, more resilient bodies, more ability to produce stem cells, can weather the storm of this warfare on their system compared to somebody who is much older who's going through these treatments.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was one of the things, because if you're able to give a higher dose of these sort of poisons and so on, because children are more resilient than an 80-year-old, for example, then you're going to be able to kill off these cancer cells sort of more successfully. And, but it soon reached this limit. So you could really go no further because it didn't answer the question. So this paradigm of cancer as a disease of growth is good, but it really leaves the question of why. Like, why are these cells growing so much? Like, we don't know the answer to that, right? So you have to take that next step and say, well, what is it that's causing cancers, and what is it that's driving these things to grow so much? So that was throughout the 70s. We had this revolution in genetics. So genetic engineering and genes and DNA and chromosome, that all came through the 50s, 60s, 70s as they identified DNA and so on. And this seemed to be the answer. So we knew all these things cause cancer. So we knew smoking, for example, caused cancer. We knew asbestos caused cancer. We knew radiation caused cancer. We knew, lots of these different things that cause cancer. We identified viruses that cause cancer. But the question is, okay, why are these separate things? So tobacco smoke and viruses, for example, which have really nothing to do with each other. Why are they causing cells to grow too much? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Why would that even happen? And this is the second sort of huge paradigm shift, which was the genetic paradigm. That is, within each cell, you have genes that basically control everything. So they control the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, you know, everything's controlled genetically. But a cell is going to have certain genes that turn on growth. That is, and there's also genes that turn off growth. So if you have a mutation in this gene that causes growth, that is either it tells the cell to grow too much, or the gene that stops the growth is turned off. So either you're basically hitting the accelerator for growth, or you're taking your foot off the brakes, right? There are genes that, you know, slam the brakes on growth. And if you take the foot off, if you immobilize, if you, you know, negate that gene, it will also be pro-growth. So this was a fantastic paradigm. Like, it was such a sort of huge advance because it took this first paradigm of cancer and answered the question of why. Well, it's a disease of genetic mutations that cause too much growth. And the question would be like, well, what's causing these genetic mutations? Well, these are random genetic mutations caused by things like tobacco smoke and viruses, which are basically causing damage to genes, right? So as you damage a cell, you're going to damage the genetic material. And this virus or tobacco smoke or asbestos if by chance one of those mutations hits a growth sort of sensitive area of the gene, you're going to get increased growth, which is going to cause cancer because it's a cell disease of too much growth. So it wasn't sort of negating the second paradigm. It was sort of building, right? So it was building an extra layer of understanding on this first paradigm.
And also that layer of understanding started to help at least some parts of the question, which is why do some people get cancer and why do they not? Where previously it was a little bit of a crapshoot. You know, you weren't exactly sure why was it that one person got it versus another. I mean, cultures had superstitions, you know, that yeah. some people were evil or deserved it or whatever it might be, you know, spirits inside the body. And now through science, we're starting to understand that, no, actually there are some factors that are playing into why some people get it and some people don't.
Yeah, exactly. So then we could identify these genetic syndromes, for example, where cancer was a very big part of it. But then the question is, say, for tobacco smoke, well, that's not purely genetics. It's not targeted genetic, you know, damage, right? When you smoke, you have damage all over the place. Why is it damaging these specific parts of the gene? And the answer in this paradigm was that, well, it's not really. It's just that... by chance, it's hitting that gene, because you can't say that asbestos is not genetically targeted like the way we can do with genetic engineering, go in and specifically target an area. This is just sort of random damage to the genome. But what they're saying is that, well, because tobacco smoke causes damage, the more times you damage, the more likely you are by chance to hit this critical area. That is just like if you buy a lot of lottery tickets, you have more chance to win the lottery, right? But in the end, it's sort of just by chance. So sometimes some people may not get a lot of smoke, but just by chance, it hits a critical area. So throughout the, you know, 70s, 80s, this genetic paradigm sort of took over from the sort of first paradigm, which is just excessive growth, built on that knowledge. And this is what a lot of people still say today. That is, you know, if you look at the American Cancer Society website, they say, oh, cancer is a disease of genetic mutations that causes too much growth. This is sort of the paradigm that we've sort of lived through most recently. So there's a huge, huge optimism. So clearly this was true. We went to the cancers. We found a lot of genetic mutations. We said, this is it. This is the answer as to why we're getting it. So the first few treatments of this genetic paradigm. So now we're saying this is a disease, not of excessive growth. That's just sort of the effect of that. This is a disease of genetic mutations. Let's go in and find these mutations and fix them. So the first drug of the sort of genetic paradigm was imatinib, which was used in a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia. And it was incredible. Like, it basically just cured the whole thing. It was ridiculously good, this drug, and sort of was one of the, and you know, was everything that was promised in this. So this was fantastic, right? So we developed this new paradigm, then we applied that knowledge to bring a drug, which wasn't an indiscriminate killer of cells. It was a fixer of genes. And therefore, that's how it worked. And this sort of validated the whole paradigm. And then shortly after that, there's another drug for breast cancer called trastuzumab, which was fantastically successful. It didn't apply to all breast cancers, but then what they did was they developed the genetic test to see if you had this mutation. And if you had the mutation, you would get the drug. And again, just incredible. What they're doing was sort of just incredible. So really a huge advance. So what the thought was is that, hey, we're just about to cure cancer. This is the 2000s. So it's a new
century. On the verge.
We're on the verge. Like, the excitement was like palpable. It's like, we are very, very close, because this is a genetic disease. We figured out what this disease is. And now we're going to use, you know, our sort of ingenuity to find it. So all we have to do is find two or three mutations that cause each cancer, find the two or three drugs that will go in and fix those, and that's it, right? So if you have liver cancer, for example, we'll find the two or three genes that are responsible for growth, and then we'll design drugs or antibodies to go in and fix them, and that'll be it. They will, you know, done. Cancer will be done. And so that was sort of a huge sort of thing, but it took a lot of time. So there was the Human Genome Project. So remember, at the time, the gene sequencing technology was very, very primitive. So there was this project called the Human Genome Project, where we're going to sequence the genes of an entire human. And that finished in 2000 and was a huge deal. It took millions of dollars. And actually, you or I could do the same thing for like $20 right now, right? It's like you go to 23andMe or something like that, right? But you could probably get your whole genome sequence for like $50. That's how far the technology has traveled. But back then, it was a huge deal. So we were like, okay, well, we're going to sequence the genes of one entire human being, and that's going to lay out the map of what we need to fix. Like, we're going to be able to pinpoint these growth genes for each specific cancer. Boom, done. It didn't quite work that way. So then they went sort of double down on this genetic paradigm, and we went to the Cancer Genome Atlas, which came about sort of in the mid-2000s. So by the mid-2000s, this technology had advanced, and we weren't going to sequence one human's genes. We're going to sequence cancers, and we were going to sequence thousands of them. So you could take, you know, say breast cancer, and take 1,000 samples of breast cancer, and then just put them all together and look for the commonalities. Like, this is the, this gene is what we need, and this gene and this gene, and then you find the drugs to block them, and then you're done. That also didn't pan out the way we thought, because what happened was that what we discovered through these huge genome sequencing things is that there weren't two or three mutations in a specific cancer. There was like 100. So if you took a colon cancer, for example, and you said, okay, well, what genes are important for colon cancer? There was like 100 different genes that were mutated. And worse, the patient next to that, you know, if you have patient A with 100 mutations, patient B with the exact looking, same looking cancer would have 100 completely different mutations. And it's like, whoa, okay, well, this is tough, because my paradigm has just been like stymied, because you cannot develop 100 new drugs for one patient and then have 100 different new drugs for the second patient, like sitting right next to him.
We were hoping to find a few commonalities, and yet there was all these differences that were there.
Exactly.
So, and the cost and time of drug development being hundreds of millions of dollars, yeah, and multiple years. So,
and
sorry.
The side effects too.
The side effects, exactly.
So you really couldn't do that, because the thing about the first few drugs, like imatinib for CML, is that virtually if you took, you know, CML, that disease, you would find that one specific sort of genetic difference in like 95% of CML sort of thing, right? So that's one specific change in the whole cancer, which is why you could develop such a great drug. If you go to colon cancer and you say, okay, well, what are my, you know, how many different mutations? It's like, well, there's 100. It's like, well, that's a lot harder than one. And it's like that one mutation may not affect all 100% of colon cancers. It may affect like 0.5% of them, right? So you're going to develop a drug which is effective for 0.5%, and 99.5% of people are not going to benefit. That's not going to be worth your time, even if you could do that, right? It's just not feasible. So in 2018, if you look at the sort of, they have this database of all the genetic mutations of cancer, the last number was somewhere close to 6 million. Million different genetic mutations.
It's incredible.
In cancer. So this whole idea, you're going to find two or three different mutations and then you're going to be able to cure them, was it. And this is the reason the genetic paradigm completely failed to bring new treatments, because the success of a paradigm is to bring new and effective treatments. And it started out really great, but then what happened was that as you started to look deeper and deeper, those were the exceptions and not the general rule. The general rule was that there's tons of mutations in these cancers.
And if I could read a little excerpt from your book that I feel like just so eloquently shapes this sort of in the second paradigm. You say cancer paradigm two had hit rock bottom. Cancer was still undefeated and the situation looked bleak. Millions of cancer research dollars over several decades produced an abundance of drugs, some truly great, but most marginally effective, yet fantastically. And this just goes to the cost of, you know, me jumping in, the cost of cancer care. So back to your sort of statement, but most marginally effective yet fantastically expensive. Benefits, borderline toxicity high, and cost still higher.
Yeah, that's unfortunately what happened, because when these drugs sort of fizzled, this paradigm sort of fizzled a little bit, there's still drugs that are still, you know, they're not very useful, but the way that the cancers are, if you have so many different mutations, each different drug is going to be much more, more marginally effective. Like it's just not going to make the same difference. So in order to recoup the costs and to make money, they just kept raising prices. And that was, you know, sort of where we are today, unfortunately. So they got these drugs, they didn't work that well. So in order to make up, they just, you know, just kept cranking up the cost. And so now, if you look at the drugs sort of 20 years ago in 2000, those drugs that were developed, like imatinib, they came out, you know, at a certain cost. The cost of that drug just kept going up and up and up. And it was ridiculous because the cost of drugs should go down. It's like your iPhone, right? If you have an original iPhone, the price of that technology goes down over time, like computing power, right? It goes down over time. With drugs, that drug is now sort of like five times the cost of what it was in 2000, yet it's the same drug. So why are the costs so high? Because there's no more research into it. There is no more technology to make this drug. The reason is they just wanted to make more money. And every drug company sort of said, well, it's a lot more profitable if we just keep it going than if we were to compete with each other on price. Let's just keep racking up the prices. So now you have drugs that are like $100,000 a year sort of thing. And unfortunately, which would be fine if they worked.
Right.
But if you look at how well they work, it's very, very, very limited usefulness. So they took, I think, 15 or 16 drugs in one study and said, well, what's the average increase in survival with using these drugs? And I think it was 2.1 months or something like that. It was very low. And if you think about it, so remember that cancer affects mostly older people. So you have to think, okay, say you're 80 years old and you get a cancer and you take a drug, which is going to cost you $200,000-$300,000. And so you will live, instead of living from 80 to 81, you'll live to 81 and 2 months. And you'll have spent like $250,000-$300,000. You'll have sold your house. You'll have bankrupted your family. Is that really worth it?
And not to mention the side effects of every additional drug that comes in, especially when people are considering quality of life at that endpoint.
Yeah. And remember that those dollars that go towards paying those exorbitant sort of fees are dollars that don't go into other things that could make a difference. That is, you know, nursing care, physiotherapy, you know, personal support workers, right? That will make a difference to your quality of life, right? Instead, you're just paying that money. I mean, that's why you have that show Breaking Bad, where the guy wound up selling meth cocaine to afford his lung cancer treatments, right? It's so expensive and everybody knows it, that it's basically out of range of the system. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I get into some of them in the book. You know, one is that they, you know, there's a change in the way they approve the drugs. So you could get drugs approved with much more marginal effectiveness than before. So the Food and Drug Administration normally has a certain bar that you have to cross before you get approved for use. And that bar got really lowered a lot because people wanted to see new drugs. So their answer to getting new drugs is to lower the bar for effectiveness. So you got new drugs, you just didn't get more effective drugs. And the problem was, of course, the paradigm that they were under, which is looking at these sort of genetic treatments, just didn't really work. And that's where I said, you know, that's where we were in about 2010. it was rock bottom. Like that, the whole thing was like, okay, cancer is still just as bad as it was because the treatments we've developed were not that effective. And the entire field was basically going, was just spinning around in circles because they couldn't find this. They needed to replace that paradigm because that paradigm was not leading them to effective treatments.
Right. And they weren't necessarily sure where it was going. So they just kept on doubling down on the things that they thought were working, or in some cases, business decisions, you know, driving the roadmap for research.
Exactly. And that's why understanding the paradigms are so important, because if you get the paradigm wrong, then you're going to go in the wrong direction. So all those drug companies, which are spending money to really look at developing great drugs for cancer, and it's billions of dollars. It's not like chump change. But if you get that paradigm wrong, then you're just chasing, you know, phantoms, right? So if you're not facing in the right direction, it doesn't matter how fast you run, you'll still never get there.
There's a architect, his name is William McDonough, very renowned gentleman who does a lot of, you know, he wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle about building building buildings, like really with the environment in mind, and not just sustainability, but buildings that are good for the environment. He says this analogy, he says, you know, if you're in a car and you're driving 100 miles per hour towards Canada, but you really should be going towards Mexico, it doesn't really do you a lot of good if all of a sudden you just slow down 60 miles per hour if you're still heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And this is the whole idea, is that you need to set a direction. So if you're doing research, if you're looking for a drug, you have to set a direction and say, okay, I'm going to attack the genetics of this problem. But if the genetics were not the main issue, then you're going in the wrong direction, and you'll, no matter how much effort you put in, you'll still never get to where you're going. And that was the reason from about 2000 to 2020, 2010, you know, there, you know, because these, some of these new drugs, they're developed sort of in the 90s. So for years, there's just nothing coming out that was making any difference. And that's where the sort of that's where most people think we are. But it's the sort of untold story is that, you know, there's this new paradigm that's sort of changed. And this is what's really important, is that now we've got this new understanding, which is hopefully going to lead us to better treatments. And it already has in some degree. So that's sort of cancer paradigm three, which again takes the core of what the genetic paradigm was, cancer 2.0, and again expands it to try to understand what the point is of these diseases. So if you look at what happens to the to the paradigm, first paradigm was cancer is cells that grow, and the question is why. So you get genetics, and it's genetics. Now you take the same sort of extra layer of understanding and say, well, why are these genes mutating? So the answer in cancer paradigm two was that they were randomly mutating. And that was clearly not true. Like, it was obviously not true, because remember that these cancers that come from, say you have a breast cancer. If you have a breast cancer in a sort of American woman in 1920 versus a Japanese woman in 2020, they're half a world apart, they're a century apart, and they will look exactly the same. And yet they've derived themselves from originally normal human breast tissue. So they look, come to the same point. That is, they look exactly the same. So there was nothing random about it. That is, if you have, you know, a colon cancer, which affects, say, a million people have independently generated this cancer, which looks identical on pathology. There's nothing random about it. It's sort of like if you have, you know, you have a classroom of children and you say, paint a picture. Well, you're going to get all different types of picture, right? You're going to get, you know, some will draw a house and some will draw a flower, right? You're going to get all different pictures. But what if every single picture was a picture of a white elephant or something like that, right? That's not random. Right?
That's when you're like, something bigger is going on here.
Something bigger is going on. There's something clearly guiding these mutations towards a predetermined spot. So if you go to a classroom analogy, maybe those children pulled out a picture and the picture was already drawn, right? It's already there and they simply color it in. And that's why everything is exactly the same, right? So this is the point, is that this was not random at all. This is something that is guided, and what is guiding it towards this thing? And that's where we started the understanding of the next paradigm of cancer, which is the evolutionary sort of ecological view of cancer. So it starts back in 2000. So a couple of researchers were talking about cancer, and what they decided was that what they wanted to do was determine basically a sort of consensus on what is cancer. So they met and they said, you know, what's interesting is that there's different types of cancer. There's breast cancer, there's lung cancer, there's liver cancer. There's all different types of cancer. And, you know, we look at the differences between these cancers, but what's the same about these cancers? What's the same about breast and colon and liver and pancreas and leukemia? What's the same about all these cancers? So in terms of a problem, this is called the lumper splitter problem sometimes. That is, when you're doing classifications, do you lump categories together or do you split them apart? So say you have mammals, you could put whales, chimpanzees, and humans all in one category because we're all mammals, we all breathe air. So you lump them all together. You can also split them apart and say, well, you know, chimpanzees and humans live on land and whales live in the water. So you can split them apart. So you can split categories, you can lump them together. They give you different information. So the lumping together highlights the similarities. And when you split them apart, it highlights the differences. So cancer medicine had always split breast cancer versus colon cancer versus lung cancer versus whatever. What was different about this paper than anything else was it was really the first attempt to lump them together and say, what is the same about all these cancers? And therefore, this wound up being the most cited paper in all of oncology. So it was basically the most important article in research article in cancer history. So it was seeing how all these cancers are the same. And what they came up with, a list of 8 hallmarks, but it basically comes down to this. Cancer cells differ from normal cells because they grow. That is, they don't stop growing, whereas normal cells should stop growing, right? Second thing was that they are immortal. So that is, if you take a cancer cell, you can actually keep growing it and growing it and growing it in lab, and you can do it forever. If you were to take one of your normal cells and try to grow and grow and grow, it will only grow, it will only divide a certain number of times before it stops. And that's called the Hayflick limit. It'll just stop, it'll die off. So it's not immortal, it's mortal. Cancer cells are completely immortal, so they'll just keep going. Third thing is that these cells tend to move around a lot, that is metastasize. That is, a lung cell stays in the lung. It doesn't go around into your big toe or something, whereas a lung cancer cell will float around and go wherever, right? And then the fourth thing is that it uses a different way of energy, which is glycolysis. So those were the really core important thing. There's always differences between the cancers, of course, but the core things that link all cancers together, the best sort of scientific consensus of what cancer was these sort of hallmarks of cancer. So in 2000, they sort of started to say, okay, well, this is what cancer is from a scientific standpoint, and how does this develop? And so they, you know, in about 2010 or so, they brought in some sort of scientists from the outside. And the idea, the National Cancer Institute had asked all these other places, physicists and astrobiologists and so on, about, you know, give us some insights into cancer. So they asked this astrobiologist by the name of Paul Davies. He studies life on other planets. That's insane. He's like, I don't know anything about cancer. And they're like, great. So from an outside point of view, we want to see what is your take on it, because physicists look at things differently than, say, a biologist will. And so the first thing he noticed was, and this was, you know, very interesting because it's so sort of fundamental, is that cancer is not a human disease. So it's actually a disease whose origins run way past humanity. That is, you know, if you look at more evolutionarily primitive animals, they still get cancer. In fact, almost every multicellular animal in existence practically gets cancer. That is, dogs get cancer, cats get cancer, rats get cancer. Even the most primitive organism, which is called a hydra, they found hydra is this microscopic thing you look at in the microscope. And even that gets cancer. So if you're
maybe not at the same rates as human beings, but they all still get cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
They have the ability to get cancer.
The ability to get cancer. And this was what's so interesting is that there doesn't seem to be any multi-celled animal that can't get cancer. Like virtually every cell in your body can become cancerous. That's very strange because it's not like you get the same thing with other diseases, right? So a gallstone is a gallstone and doesn't affect your, you know, thumb or something like that, right? But every cell, your skin cells can become cancerous, your eyes can get cancerous, your heart can get cancer, your lungs can get cancer. Every single cell, even the placenta can get cancer. So it's like, okay, every single cell can get cancerous, not only in the human body, but practically every cell in a multicellular animal has that ability to become a cancer. So whatever this thing called cancer is embedded extremely deeply, way past humanity and human genes. So don't look in your human genes because the origin of cancer went way back to evolutionary times. And this was the sort of insight that set into motion this sort of next understanding of cancer as an evolutionary disease. So if you look at the differences between a single-celled organism and a multi-celled organism, there's a very fundamental jump that needs to happen when you go from a single cell to a multi-celled organism. That is, single-celled organisms compete with each other for food. So say you have a slice of bread and you have mold on a slice of bread, which is a fungus, right? Those mold will compete with each other until the food is gone, then they'll die. There's no cooperation, but they just are basically each mold or each fungi or each bacteria, they're all basically out for themselves. So they compete with each other. When you get into a multicellular system, there are some important changes in that you have to learn how to cooperate together. So when you have several different cells, you have a lung cell which does one thing and a liver cell which does another thing, but they need to coordinate because the liver can't get oxygen and the lung can't detoxify. So they rely on each other. But what you can do is you can specialize and you can dominate your environment. And that's the advantage, is that you have specialization, you have, you know, you can get bigger and so on. So you're going to compete more successfully. So it's the difference between competition, which is the domain of the single-celled organism, and cooperation, which is a multi-celled organism. So the cells within a multicellular organism, they have to cooperate. So it's like the difference between, say, an individual, like who plays an individual sport like tennis. Everybody else is a competitor, right? You can't have five winners of the French Open or whatever. Like you only have one winner. That's individual sports. When you get to a team sport, what happens is that you have to learn how to cooperate with your other team members. So say you play soccer or something like that, right? Then what's going to happen is that you specialize. So you have forwards and defense and midfielders and goalies, right? And it gets bigger, but you have to learn to cooperate. The other
more
players
in the system, the more cooperation that's needed.
Exactly. So that's a huge fundamental shift in the way that multicellular life is done. And there, when you compare cells in a multicelled organism compared to what single-celled organisms do, they differ in several fundamental ways because of this, you know, competition versus cooperation. So if you look at single-celled organisms, they tend to grow. They will grow and grow and grow, and they will never stop until they sort of run out of resources. The second thing is that they move around. So single-celled organisms, if they exhaust their food source, they need to move around, right? Nothing stops them from moving around. In multi-celled organisms, you want people to stay in the same place because your lung depends on your liver being in a certain place, and they have to be in the same place, and they can't grow. You can't have the lung keep growing and growing and growing, right? The third thing is that they're immortal. So if you look at bacteria, they're completely immortal. You can grow a bacteria in a flask in a lab and just keep growing them and growing them and growing them. As long as you keep putting in fresh medium, you're going to keep growing. So they're immortal. Whereas cells in a multicellular organism don't. They will die after a while. And then the fourth thing is the way they generate energy. Bacteria tend to use glycolysis, which is different from this thing called oxidative phosphorylation. But if you look at it, it's like, wow, the way that the cancer cell differs from a normal cell is exactly the same way that cells in a multi-celled organism differ from a single-celled organism. But that single-celled organism is the evolutionary ancestor of all the original cells. That is all that programming in that single-celled organism to grow, to move around, to become immortal. That's all there. That was never in evolutionary time. That was never changed. They just built new programs on top of it. So that old original sort of kernel of programming of that single-celled sort of survivalist mentality all still exists in all of our cells.
The source code has been there since the beginning, right?
Exactly. And what's happening
for this cancer cells.
Exactly. And so what people said was that, well, this is not a coincidence, because what's really happening now is that you have that original source code that's buried deep, and you have all this other programming on top, which subverts all your programming to change the sort of competitive nature to a cooperative nature. But when you get damaged to all of this other code, then this original source code sort of comes through. And that's why all the cancers in history all sort of look the same, because all of it was buried there already. Whether you live in Japan or whether you live in America, whether you're in 2020 or 1820, this stuff goes back millions of years, all the way back from the jump from unicellularity to multicellularity. That's because cancer is the way that cancer differs is fundamental. That difference is fundamental to the way that life evolved on Earth.
Right.
That's why it affects everything.
And you know, jumping a little bit ahead, but part of the question that comes along with it is that, is cancer something that happens to us, or is it a survival mechanism, right? That's not maybe the words that you would use, but just using like words for the sake of this conversation. Is this an inherent sort of thing that was programmed? It's in all cells, not just human beings. And is it some sort of survival mechanism that cells have?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So it's actually the most sort of survivable way that a cell can be. So a lung cell, if you stretch back from the original cell, from when it originally came from a single cell to a multi-cell, there's all those genes that are programmed in there, which are sort of survivalist genes. These are the genes that will survive on its own, not being part of us, this sort of cooperative team. And when all of this damage happens to everything else, you start to activate these sort of survivalist genes. And that is the way that cancer develops. So the reason that a lot of these, these things like tobacco smoke and viruses and stuff, what they do is that they exert a sort of selective pressure. It's got to be chronic, and it's got to be a sublethal damage, so that you're basically providing the environment that is necessary for this sort of survivalist tendency to succeed. That is the only thing that is powerful enough to drive this change in cancer from a normal cell to a cancer cell is evolution. So what you need in evolution is a selective pressure. And that's what these chronic carcinogens, so chronic exposures, cause. is a selective pressure. That is, it has to be chronic because it needs time for evolution to happen. And it needs to be sublethal, because if you just kill all cells, then everybody's dead, right? Nothing survives to become cancer. If it's too weak, it's just not strong enough. It has to be somewhere in the middle. So this sort of chronic damage to a cell, like you get with tobacco smoke, with
tobacco
viruses.
Ultra processed food that is known to have a carcinogen effect, air pollutants that are there, lead, arsenic, like all in that same category.
Exactly. So these chronic sort of sublethally damaging things will actually cause the cell to say, okay, well, now, you know, how am I going to survive, right? If I just keep doing what I'm doing, I'm going to die. So therefore, I'm going to start to activate some of this old programming, which is sort of in the way back, and I'm going to activate those genes that are similar to being a unicellular organism. So in other words, the cell is actually evolving sort of in a backwards manner, which is called an atavism, towards its sort of original form. And that's what the cancer is basically a single-celled organism, because that's what was programmed in all of us, and explains actually a lot of the phenomena that we see in cancer. That is, why does it affect so many people? That is because it's in all of us. The seed of cancer actually lies in every single one of our cells. And that's why it's so common, in terms of it affects all animals, all multicellular animals, and it affects every cell. Every different type of cell in our body can become cancerous. Why? Because that was there from the beginning.
And if I could add one context layer for our audience, it's there. It's not just why does it affect so many of us, but it also starts to explain that now we understand, okay, the source code was there from the beginning, but it's activated by these pressures. It then starts to explain, why did we see an uptick in these cancers in more modern history? Well, the pressures have increased. And just being mindful of your time, since I know I only have a little bit of, you know, more time with you, I think this is a perfect opportunity to jump into. You've sort of set the stage for this. It's kind of central point that comes into, okay, so now that we understand this in part of paradigm three, you use this sort of seed and soil, you know, analogy. And I'd love to set that up just to make sure that we get to that while I have you here.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So if we understand now, this is an evolutionary process which goes back towards our origins, then you have to say, what drives evolution? And it's not just genetics. So if you think about evolution, Darwinian evolution, which is the survival of the fittest, for example. So what he had observed was that in the Galapagos Islands, he had these birds. And if they had these short beaks, which were really ideal for eating nuts, and there are birds that these had these long beaks that were really good for eating fruit. And in the areas where there's a lot of nuts, you found a lot of these short-beaked animals, and the areas you had a lot of fruit, you had a lot of these long-beaked animals. And that what he said was, that's not a coincidence. What happens is that the environment selects the genes that are most successful. So if you have a lot of nuts, you select for the genes, that's a selective pressure, which favors the survival of those genes that produce the short, thick beak. And the areas that have a lot of fruit have exert a selective pressure on the genes that give you the long, narrow beaks, right? That makes sense. It's just sort of basic evolution. And cancer does sort of the same thing. So if it's an evolutionary process towards this sort of original being caused by chronic damage to the cell, then it's not the genetics, which is the important part, but it's the environment, right? And that is, the seed of cancer is there, but if you don't provide that environment that, you know, selects for this sort of survivalist, cancerous sort of, you know, story, then you're not going to get cancer. So what you have to do then is to say, this is not just a genetic disease, because for years we've been sort of thinking about it as a genetic disease. So we think, well, it's just sort of pre-programmed into us, but it's not, because the rates of cancer depend on your environment more than it does on your genes. That is, if you look at, say, breast cancer, breast cancer, if you go from Japan, a Japanese woman in Japan, when you move that person to San Francisco, their rate of breast cancer like doubles or triples within a couple of generations.
Crazy.
It's the environment. But that's fantastic, because then if you can figure out what part of the environment is what's selecting for the damage. So, in some cases we know it's smoking, it's tobacco, it's viruses, right? In many cases, we don't know breast cancer, colon cancer, what's the damage, prostate cancer, we don't know. If we can figure out what part of the environment is driving this evolutionary process, then that's how we're going to reduce the risk of cancer. And so the question is, what is it in our environment? So they've studied this question for a long time. So back in 1981, they did a study where they're going to estimate the risks. So we do something called a population attribution factor, which is what percentage a certain risk factor will contribute to cancer. So tobacco smoke is the biggest, 35%. So tobacco is responsible roughly for 35% of cancer overall. But number two was the diet at around 30%, right? So really like very, very close to tobacco and dwarfing almost everything else. So all the stuff like the pesticides and the chemicals and stuff, that's like 1 or 2%, radiation, 1 or 2%. But cancer was caused in large part due to one, tobacco, which we know about, and two, the diet. The question
which is, never really got that, like people didn't get that, you know, like
people didn't,
that. They didn't get it that. Was,
and so they were looking for what part of the diet, that was what the tricky part was. So if it's diet, then what part of the diet is causing cancer, right? So they looked at fiber, wasn't the case. They looked at dietary fat, it wasn't the case. They looked at vitamin deficiencies. And we've done so many studies like vitamin A, vitamin B, folic acid, vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, omega-3 fatty acids, selenium. We've tested all of those in multi-million dollar trials, and it wasn't deficiency of vitamins that was causing cancer. And the answer came somewhere around 2000, what part of the diet was the most important. And we didn't know this really until about 2003. And it turns out that it was obesity was the biggest driver of cancer. And probably more specifically is that it was the hyperinsulinemia. That is the too much insulin, which is very typical of obesity, is probably the what's driving cancer in those cases. And the reason I say we didn't know is because, so I went to medical school in the mid-1990s and we never talked about this stuff. No. But in 2003, a very large study came out which showed that obesity actually raises the risk of all kinds of cancer. So now the WHO classifies 13 different types of cancer as obesity related, including breast cancer and colorectal cancer, which are after lung cancer, sort of the most common cancers. So really, really important causes. And this is what's important is now, you know, what we're doing is we have to go past again. So this paradigm, which gets us to evolution, which gets us to the seed and the soil, which is this sort of evolutionary ecology being the study of how the environment interacts with an individual. How you can change that environment in order to prevent cancer. And that's sort of what's sort of exciting about this is that now hopefully we can start to understand and then make some changes that are going to minimize our risk of developing these types of cancers and, hopefully preventing them in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, and even question basic premises. You know, I was on the Mayo Clinic website in preparation of this interview. You know, there's like a myths and there's like a myths and facts section on cancer and diet. And like one of the questions inside of there was sugar, you know, somebody saying, you know, does consuming less sugar have any impact on cancer? Right. And it was like, there's no research, there's no evidence at all that consuming less sugar has anything to do with cancer. And again, Mayo Clinic, well-established place. They're doing the best they can based on the research and the evidence that's out there right now. And part of the thing that you're bringing in is that highlighting, especially with your previous books, that we're really talking about, you know, insulin resistance and what that relates to diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes, is, well, if we know that obesity through this big study that you were talking about plays a major factor, and then what is it as part of that also contributes obesity, and how do cancer cells get their energy, then of course we're going to want to pay attention to the level of, you know, sugars as one example that we're having inside of our diet, because that's going to cause a whole chain of effects that ultimately supports the growth of cancer.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of so Dr. Lou Cantley, who's a very prominent researcher, cancer researcher, he was one of the ones who sort of uncovered the link between sort of what sugar does, which is, you know, it contributes to this high insulin state. And insulin, other than being a metabolic hormone, is actually a very, very potent growth factor. So it tells cells to grow. And if you're going to tell cells to grow, then you're going to tip the scales in towards, increasing growth of cancer cells, for example. So, you know, here's a guy who's sort of like one of the most prominent cancer researchers, and he's like, sugar scares me. You know, that's what he says in one of his articles he's written. It's like, okay, well, that's all I need to know, right?
Totally. And also too, on the basic premise of like, what is chemotherapy, right?
Yeah.
Could you explain like that link on that? Like, how do they get these well-intentioned poisons into cancer cells? Can you explain that to like our audience through, you know, like exactly like what goes into chemotherapy that takes advantage of exactly that we're talking about?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So when you look at the cancer cells, you can do something called a PET test, which is a positron emission test. And it basically looks at how avidly cells take up glucose. So when you do these tests, things that light up are eating a lot of glucose, and those are what are identified as cancer. So they're taking in, you know, like 5 or 10 times the amount of glucose, which is a type of sugar compared to normal cells. So it's like, okay, when you look on these sophisticated sort of scans, you can see the cancer cells basically devouring sugar like there's no tomorrow. And it's like, well, you know, if I had cancer, I certainly wouldn't be trying to eat too much of this stuff, because you know that the one place in the body that loves it 10 times more than the next guy is the thing, right? And then you have certain chemotherapies which take advantage of this. They try and get in, you know, because they're, you know, they mimic the sugar, and that's how they do it on the positron emission tomography testing, for example. They mimic the sugar so that the cancer takes it up and then it lights it up. And then people are trying to use that to sort of target the cancers as well. But interesting, it's an interesting story of how this sort of this new paradigm explains so much more about the phenomenon of cancer and how, you know, what implications it has for screening, and this sort of evolution of, and this is sort of the promise of this cancer paradigm 3.0, is that if you now understand that what is happening now is that the cell is evolving away from normal cells, evolving into a foreign species. Because, and people always think, oh, that's so weird, right? But that's the way the body actually looks at the cancer cells. So when our immune system looks at a cell, it has a way to tell between self and non-self. That is, the immune system is a very powerful weapon. You don't want to use it on its own cells. That's like friendly fire, right?
Type behavior.
Exactly. And it's very, very bad if that happens. So your body has these ways to distinguish between your own cells and everybody else. So bacteria, viruses, it will try and kill it. And when it sees a cancer, it will try and kill it. That's just the way, that's what happens. So it has evolved, this cell. So say you take a lung cell, this lung cell, which was originally your own cell, has evolved into basically a new species that is foreign. That's why
Frankenstein in your own body.
Exactly. And that's the reason that instead of trying to, the third paradigm, which is like, okay, now we have these cells that were originally part of us, but they've basically broken away and they've become their own sort of, you know, invader. Now you say, well, instead of trying to just get indiscriminate killing, which was paradigm one, or genetic targeting, which was paradigm two, now what we're going to do is enhance the immune system to identify it. So basically you have these sleeper cells, like, you know, you have terrorists, sleeper cells of terrorists in your city. And now what you're trying to do is uncover them so that you can get your police and your SWAT teams in there to kill these sort of domestic terrorists. That's what we're doing with immunotherapy. So these new drugs, these checkpoint inhibitors, are basically uncovering. So there are certain ways that these cancer cells hide, and they're basically trying to uncover them, right? And this is the new paradigm. What we're going to do is trying to uncover these sleeper cells, these hidden sleeper cells, so that they can be identified, targeted. We can, you know, direct the immune system. So something like those new drugs you're talking about, the you know, those checkpoint inhibitors, then you get CAR T, where you're actually going to take the cancer and then engineer a sort of a SWAT team that is going to identify and kill them, right? That's a new therapy based on this immunotherapy, but it's based more specifically on this new paradigm of looking at a cancer as a new foreign species. And it's very, very interesting because, you know, it's the promise is sort of immense. Like, we're not there yet. And I hope that there's a lot more to come, but it's a totally new way of targeting cancer and treating it based on a whole new paradigm. And that's what gives me hope for the future, that there's more going to be able to be applied, because you can apply these lessons of evolutionary biology and say, well, you know, what can I do to change the environment, for example, because that's evolution, that's biology. So things like losing weight and, you know, intermittent fasting, which is another way to lose weight, you know, trying to reverse your type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetics, of course, get much higher rates of cancer because it's also hyperinsulinemic. So reversing the type 2 diabetes, that's going to likely reduce your risk. You know, to other things like chemo preventative agents. So there's not a lot. They've been studying stuff to try and prevent cancer, but there's not a lot. So the only things that might work, metformin gets a lot of research, which is a diabetes drug, may be useful. And then green tea, probably a very small effect, but there's some data from, you know, from Japan, where they do drink a lot of green tea, that some of the compounds in that are maybe effective. So maybe that's a great, you know, great thing to do. Drinking green tea is probably good anyway.
And really the two central themes that I got out of your book after really going through that history is, one, the future is hopeful in a way that is really understanding more of that central question, coming back to how we start off the podcast, which is, what the heck is cancer? So we're better shaped for what we're developing in terms of treatments and drugs in the future, because we have the most robust answer that's actually getting to the source and the root of what is cancer. And the second component is exactly kind of what you were just talking about, which is, what are the things that you can do today to both enhance, you know, whether it's some of the work of like Walter Longo or other people that are out there that are showing that fasting could support, right? Targeted fasting, especially before chemotherapy, can support and enhance the potency of these drugs if somebody actively has cancer. Cutting off the source of the supply of food, which is significantly reducing the amount of glucose so that we're not in this place of, you know, hyperinsulinemia. And if you don't have cancer right now, and this is something that you're paying attention to in the future, what would be your biggest recommendations? You know, somebody who's healthy, who's listening to this podcast right now, and they're like, wow, this is all super fascinating. I've never understood this before, but now I get it. It's almost like you just gave us a masterclass on cancer. What are the one or two things to do today, besides not smoking, that will help us be the most resilient to potentially avoid this disease in the future or greatly minimize our risk?
Yeah. And so you get back to those sort of attributable risk, which is number one is tobacco smoke. So of course, that's probably the single most important thing, and still is to not smoke. And then two is the diet. So avoiding hyperinsulinemia, which is that sort of what I talk about more in the obesity code and the type 2 diabetes, in the diabetes code, is that insulin is this hormone which tends to make us gain weight and also causes insulin resistance. And too much insulin is a very potent growth factor. So that's going to, so if you're, you know, you want to avoid things that are going to try, that are going to raise insulin, which is eating a very a diet that is very high in refined carbohydrates, for example, sugar is probably something you should best take, you know, in small amounts. And then this other idea is that you really should be having a regular period of fasting every day. That's really sort of basic. It's the word breakfast. It's the meal that breaks your fast, because really you're supposed to be eating at, say, dinner time, which is, say, 6 o'clock, and eating at breakfast time, which is maybe 8 o'clock. So you're getting somewhere between 12 and 14 hours of fasting every single day. That's what's supposed to happen. That's buried in the word breakfast, right? Break fast. That is what's supposed to happen every day. That's not what happens to most of us in 2020. Because if you look at sort of societal norms and stuff, instead of having three meals and then no snacks, we sort of graze throughout the day, believing that it's actually healthy for us. I don't think it is, because every time you are eating, you're stimulating your insulin, which is giving growth signals to the cells, including the cancer cells, which love insulin. You know, you look at a breast cancer cell, for example, has like 5 or 6 times the number of insulin receptors compared to a normal breast cell. They love this stuff. They love insulin. They love glucose. So therefore, you want to lower it. So eating sort of whole unprocessed foods is important. That's probably the most important thing. Not eating all the time is probably the second most important thing. And, you know, maintaining a normal weight as best as you can. I mean, that's not always the easiest thing to do, but if you are overweight, then try to lose that weight. If you are type 2 diabetic, try to reverse that type 2 diabetes. And that's the two, you know, The tobacco and the diet are so overwhelmingly more important than everything else. Like, you could also, you know, look at the viruses, for example. You can get the, you know, try to avoid the hepatitis B and hepatitis C, which cause cancer, and human papillomavirus. But those are sort of givens. But the diet and the tobacco are sort of in a class of their own. Everything else is like 2%, and they're at like 30-35%.
And you know, I think I just want to say, from somebody from the outside who's been an observer of your work and consuming it and just super appreciative, the cigarette piece is easy, you know, tough to break, but actually there's really a lot of really interesting stuff that's coming out of Johns Hopkins and other places of using psychedelics to help break cigarette cessation. You know, maybe those things will incorporate and we'll figure out new ways to help people. I think it's about 15% of the adult population smokes here in the United States. So it's gone down massively, and cancer rates have gone down for that. The diet, sometimes people listening here, if they're not familiar with your work, can think, okay, he's just talking about eating healthy, but really you're talking about getting out of this central paradigm, to use the word, where we're eating sugar in all its other forms. So people who are listening are like, I don't really have a lot of sugar in my diet, you know, maybe a little bit in my coffee, some birthday cake here and there when I'm at parties, but you know, how often are you eating those meals of refined starches that are a regular part of our daily life? The big bowls of rice or ultra processed foods or breads or other things like that, that fine, you know, have those things every so often as, you know, parts of your diet. But when they become the norm, now you understand why so much of America is in that pre-diabetic state where they think they might be eating healthy because they're just a little bit overweight, but actually their diet is constantly spiking their blood sugar, which leads to all these problems with insulin that you're talking about. So you're not just talking about eating healthy, let's be a little bit more mindful. You're talking about really actually leaning in and getting your blood sugar under control.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, one of the ways, I mean, a lot of people talk about diets and there's all these different opinions on diets, but what people hadn't focused on really at all, I think, until a few years ago was this meal timing. That is eating all the time really the same as eating, you know, a few times? And I think the answer is no, because the point is that you need to let your body sort of digest, let your insulin levels fall so that you don't get all these problems with the insulin resistance and so on, because insulin is not intrinsically bad, but it is a hormone that goes up when you eat. So if you eat constantly, is that a bad thing? And that's not been talked about a lot. And that's what I've really focused on, is that I think it's actually highly detrimental to be eating constantly. It's just not the way that you're supposed to be doing it. And we've never done it.
Which was a little bit of the trend of some of the advice, especially in like the 90s and 2000s, eat six meals a day, you know, graze throughout the day. And really, you know, we're backing away from that largely through the work that people like yourself are doing and just educating, well, let's actually look, is this actually helpful or could it be harmful? And it's looking like it's not supportive of our overall health goals inside the body.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole idea was sort of silly that you should eat to lose weight. And it's like, well, how's that going to work exactly? Right? If you're eating all the time, how are you expecting to lose weight? And you know, of course, that if you eat a little bit and then stop, that doesn't suppress your appetite. It increases it. That's what an appetizer is. It's a small portion of food to make you more hungry, not less hungry, more hungry, right? So if you're going to eat small portions of food, you're going to stimulate your appetite, then you're going to stop, right? It's like when you start urinating, you just want to finish, right? When you start eating, you just want to finish. If you were to go pee and you just stop and start and stop and start, it's like, why would you want to do that? Like, that's the dumbest thing ever, right? So it's like, you're going to make yourself hungry by taking a little appetizing portion of food, and then you're going to stop, right? It's like, oh, well, that's not really useful. And then you're going to do it again and again and again, six times a day. Well, why would you want to do that? That's ridiculous, because it's never been done before. Because prior to like 1977, nobody did that. So why would you even think that it's a good thing to do? Like, why would you even come up with that? And the answer is that there was no real scientific evidence that it actually helpful. It was just sort of made up. People just thought it might be good and they just said it, and that's it.
Sure. Well, you know, there's that old saying that I don't know who discovered water, but it probably wasn't a fish. Sometimes we're so in the cultural norms of the way that things have been done that it actually takes a lot of courage, especially for somebody in your position, to step back and say, wait, does any of this make sense? Let's start with the basics and let's question the premise and then go from there. If not, we're in this rat race where today, still in the US, unfortunately, number one reason for bankruptcy is medical bills. Cancer rates are continuing to go up. Quality of life is not increasing. Out of 90% of our insurance dollars that we pay in, young people, old people, everybody, out of all the insurance dollars that we pay in, 90% of it is used in the last 6 to 8 months of somebody's life to try to keep them alive through these expensive treatments. A lot of them well-intentioned, that are there. Some maybe coming from business perspectives, but it's not a winning race. We have to step back and we have to question the basic idea. And that's exactly, Dr. Fung, what you do inside this book. And I want to thank you for really putting together some strong material. I hope, progressive medical schools out there start to make it required reading, because, you know, as we all know on this podcast, is that it can take 12, 17, 20 years for what's the latest literature to end up becoming part of the practice that's out there. So kudos to you for writing an incredible book. I want to just take a moment here, again, trying to be mindful of your time, for you to talk about some of the initiatives. The book is out there by the time this interview is going to be out there. So we'll have the link in the show notes. But you also are involved in a couple other initiatives, and I'd love for you to get a chance to explain those to our audience, especially the ones around fasting.
Yeah, so I have a website called thefastingmethod.com, and there's a lot of sort of free material. So I have a blog, and there's probably like 6 or 7 years worth of blogs sitting in there. So there's a ton of information all there, as well as links to YouTube videos, which have lectures and that kind of thing. And you can also follow me on Twitter or Instagram. That's at Dr. Jason Fung. That's Dr. Jason Fung. And then the Fasting Method also has a paid program where we try to provide the sort of help for people, because people, you know, might have good intentions of fasting to lose weight and reverse type 2 diabetes and so on, but they need some help to do it. So this is hopefully providing some of the sort of necessary tools, the community, supportive community, sort of answering questions, provide the education necessary. You know, what do I do if this happens? And what do I know if this happens? So really trying to provide that supportive, environment that people can succeed in it. I also worked with a company called Peak Tea, which provides the a line of fasting tea. So that's,
I love them. They're great.
I think they're really good. I drink them like every day almost. And it comes as these packets of tea. So it's crystallized tea. So they brew the tea and then cold brew crystallize it. So there's actually higher levels of certain antioxidants called catechins, which are thought to be appetite suppressing and so on. So that's why it might be a little bit useful and very useful adjunct to fasting if you're having difficulty. So they have a whole line of fasting tea, which I worked with them on. And that's, you know, hopefully, you know, all things trying to help people do the fasting. Fasting itself is very easy. And if you can do it, great. But if you need some help to get healthy, to reverse your diabetes, to lower your weight, which will ultimately, hopefully, reduce your risk of cancer, those are all great things.
Yeah. And I would say that these are all great resources, even if you're in the pre-diabetes state, which is where so many people are, right? We have so many people in that state. So you don't just have to have diabetes. If you notice that you're gaining belly fat, you know, you're getting a little larger as your years increase, you know, and you have looked at your blood work and you see that you're in that pre-diabetic range, which we talk about, Dr. Hyman talks about, talk about, fasting is a central tool for addressing that before. You don't have to wait till you get diagnosed with diabetes. You can embrace some of these tools and support systems that Dr. Fung has set up. Fantastic interview. Really, thank you so much for taking the time to take us on this journey and this educational history. The Cancer Code, it's out. A revolutionary new understanding of a medical mystery. We'll have the link in the show notes. Dr. Fung, thank you for being with us on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great.